Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. This Friday, April the 13th, 2018. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
And coming up on the show, Congo boycotts an international donor conference accusing aid organizations of exaggerating the country's crisis.
We do not refer to this attempt to raise a colossal budget by portraying a false image of the humanitarian needs in our country as international support. We call it marketing humanitarian aid.
And Ugandan authorities admit they are considering taking hundreds of African refugees from Israel.
The state of Israel has requested Uganda to allow about 500 refugees of Eritrean and Sudanese origin to be relocated to Uganda.
These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you, but first, here's a chance to listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres has spoken out strongly on the increasing tensions over Syria. At a meeting of the Security Council on Friday, Guterres said all states involved need to act responsibly to avoid a full-scale military escalation. Several Western nations are considering military strikes against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces in retaliation for an alleged chemical weapons attack on a rebel stronghold outside the capital Damascus, in which more than 40 people are believed to have died. The alleged chemical attack has positioned the West against Russia and Syria as both sides continue to trade barbs over responsibility, barbs that could further destabilize the troubled region. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has urged both sides to find a political solution.
The repeated use of chemical weapons that are internationally outlawed cannot remain without consequences. One cannot simply move on to the agenda. That is what we now need to discuss with our Western partners. The aim must always be to reach a political solution in the end. There will be no lasting peace in the Syrian conflict without political solutions.
Politische Lösung wird es keinen dauerhaften Frieden geben.
In Uganda, the government said that it is positively considering accepting around 500 Eritrean and Sudanese migrants from Israel, adding that its motivation is purely humanitarian and not financially driven. Israel has been trying to deport some 40,000 African migrants who reportedly entered the country illegally since November last year. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. The results are now out for Thursday's local elections in the Gambia. The overwhelming winner was the United Democratic Party of President Adama Barrow. DW correspondent Omar Wali has more from Banjul.
President Barrow's party won 62 of 120 possible seats, while the former ruling APRC party won 18 seats, almost all in ex-president Hajime's home region of Fonyi. Although the election were the first since Jammeh was removed from power last year, many voters choose to stay at home. Aliu Momor Njai, the chairman of the Electoral Commission, had this comment on the turnout.
The only setback we had is the low voter turnout. And this low voter turnout, we've done everything possible to CSOs, other partners, to sensitize the public. But still, they didn't come out to vote as they should.
The United Nations Children's Fund has reported that the militant Boko Haram group abducted more than 1,000 children in northeast Nigeria since 2013. The Islamist jihadists have been trying since 2009 to establish an Islamic caliphate in the region, where more than 20,000 people have died in the conflict. 4 years ago, 276 Chibok schoolgirls were kidnapped by the militants. 100 girls are still reported missing. And now in sports, Bayern Munich have confirmed that Niko Kovac is to replace head coach Jupp Heynckes, who is set to retire. Kovac has been given a 3-year contract. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. Thank you for joining us live on air and on Facebook. And feel free to take part in the program by sharing your thoughts and opinions on the stories that we are covering.
That's very right, Abu. And we'll read some of them whenever we can. Now let's get down to business. The Democratic Republic of Congo on Friday boycotted an international donor conference held in Geneva to assist the country's displaced persons. Kinshasa accuses humanitarian organizations of misrepresenting the crisis in Congo.
Now, at the donor conference, only a quarter of the $2.2 billion sought was raised. The conference comes amid fears of mounting violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where decades of corruption, instability, and ethnic conflict are colliding with deepening political tensions. Eddie Micah Jr. with this report, which was written by Philip Zanna.
For those who have fled their homes, the crisis in DR Congo is very real. Some have even compared it to the country's past civil wars. Regarding Friday's donor conference, which was meant to raise funds for Congo's displaced persons, DRC Minister of Communications, Lambert Mende, said international organizations were deliberately misrepresenting refugee numbers in order to keep lining their pockets.
We do not refer to this attempt to raise a colossal budget by portraying a false image of the humanitarian needs in our country as international support. We call it marketing humanitarian aid.
Congo's government is at loggerheads with humanitarian organizations over the scale of the refugee crisis. Congo's Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, Bernard Biango, puts the number of internally displaced people at 230,000, nearly 20 times lower than UN estimates. Congo boycotted the aid conference, Mende said, because the numbers of refugees given by the UN simply do not match the reality on the ground.
The high numbers of displaced people are frightening investors, and the country needs investment for development rather than development aid.
According to French broadcasters RFI, the Congolese government had written to some potential donors asking them to boycott the conference. The United Arab Emirates reportedly cancelled its attendance. The UN warned in March that the crisis in Congo was at a breaking point. During a trip to the country last week, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, also described the challenges they are facing in DRC.
Unfortunately, operations, refugee operations, humanitarian operations in the Democratic Republic of Congo continue to be underfunded everywhere. And this is unfortunately in common with many other emergency operations, humanitarian operations in Africa.
According to the UN, some 600,000 Congolese have fled violence since 2017. In addition, around 4.3 million people are now internally displaced. DR Congo is also home to around 500,000 refugees from other countries.
That report was written by Philip Zanna.
Right. And Abu, there are some comments coming in on that story. We asked you on Facebook about this story of Congo boycotting this donor conference. And the question was whether Congo pride, I mean, they're obviously proud
indeed,
that they didn't want to take part in this conference. Is it a clever or a silly move? And Sophia Heritage says the boycott is a silly move by the criminal government of DRC, which fears damaging an image that has already been damaged by the same government anyways. She says, if you fear a damaged image, then do the right things that uphold an image of pride and decency.
And along that same line, we have Obino Chigozi, who says, it's a very clever move. Africans are not cheap. Revoke their mining license. They stole our resources and give us cheap money.
That's a very interesting comment. Ndimbenyi Oscar says, Western countries are scavengers. People's eyes are opening.
And Ramsey Jallo says, I support the idea of the DR Congo.
Bayer Jeremiah comments, a silly move. The country is having bad image because of the bad leadership and not because of the activities of the UN. Still a sign of wickedness and bad leadership. And moving on to the wild story now, Russia's foreign minister has claimed that a suspected gas attack in the Syrian town of Douma was staged with the help of Britain. Speaking to reporters in Moscow, Sergei Lavrov said a foreign intelligence agency helped fabricate the attack, but he offered no evidence and did not name the country in question.
Meanwhile, an international fact-finding mission has arrived in Syria to investigate the alleged attack. What they find could determine if the US and its ally followed through with threats of a retaliatory strike. Russia has warned any such act could trigger war. Anchil Voral has been following the story from neighboring Lebanon and has been speaking to my colleague Amrita Chima about the arrival of the OPCW team.
Well, the team arrived in Beirut last evening. They should be in Damascus today, and tomorrow they will be going to Douma. The Syrian regime has invited them and says that they would be given all the access that they require, and they would be taken everywhere that they ask to go. Now, having said that, the Russian boots are on the ground. So in the Western countries, in America especially, there is a fear that the Russians would have already cleaned up. And in that sense, the OPCW will not find anything of any significance.
Meanwhile, we are seeing a sustained U.S. naval buildup off the coast of Syria and an increase in American air activity. What is a general view there on the possibility of military strikes?
Well, the work that's on in Washington now is how can they not hit Russian assets, but just hit the Syrian assets. But that's going to be very difficult because over the last 3 days, Bashar al-Assad has moved Syrian assets on the Russian bases. The forces are now scattered. Now, if you we know that the U.S. Navy destroyers are now in the Mediterranean, and they do have Tomahawk missiles. Tomahawk missiles are dumb missiles, which essentially means that when they hit, the target is not precise. Now, this year, when Trump says that it's going to be a smart strike, he's talking about PGMs, precision-guided missiles. Now, these, if he uses, there is a chance that he does hit specifically Syrian assets and not Russian assets. But we have to remember, we're also hearing rhetoric from Russians, and they have a very supreme air defense system. So they can actually shoot down these missiles up in the air.
Anchil Voral speaking from neighboring Lebanon.
And let's get back to Africa and talk about the Ugandan confession. Following months of denials, Uganda finally said that it was positively considering taking hundreds of African migrants from Israel.
Now, Uganda's junior refugee minister, Musa Echweru, admitted that Israel had requested that Uganda takes in about 500 migrants from Eritrea and Sudan. He, however, denied any suggestion of a financial motive, saying that the action is purely humanitarian. From Kampala, Alex Chita filed this report.
Reports of African migrants coming to Uganda from Israel have been making rounds in the media, and the Uganda government has always denied them. But today, Uganda's Minister of Refugees and Disaster Preparedness, Musa Echweru, clarified the report in a press conference.
The State of Israel has requested Uganda to allow about 500 refugees of Eritrean and Sudanese origin to be relocated to Uganda. I want to make it abundantly clear that the government and my ministry are positively considering this request.
Echweru said the refugees will still go through a rigorous process to ascertain if they are suitable to be granted asylum status. It was alleged that any country that accepts the migrants would get paid by Israel. But Echweru denied that Uganda benefited financially.
Already we have 1.4 million refugees here in Uganda. We have not been paid a cent. In fact, it is us spending our limited resources to make sure that we make them have a second home here in Uganda. So there is no payment attached to this. It is purely humanitarian.
When refugees are received, they are handed over to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. But the UNHCR office in Uganda says they have no idea about the arrival of the African migrants. One of the organizations taking care of refugees in Uganda is World Vision. They say the refugee numbers are soaring, but the money and other resources provided to manage them have not changed. Their Ugandan spokesperson, Moses Mukitare, told DWO that resources are constrained.
Some of them have to eat a meal a day or have to forego some meals sometimes so that they are able to have food enough for the month. So we need much funding right now. We need countries to commit more.
Israel is expelling about 38,000 immigrants, mainly from Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Sudan. The efforts to forcefully expel them were challenged by rights bodies, saying these were asylum seekers who were fleeing persecution in their home countries.
Alex Jita compiled that report in Kampala. Stay with Africa Link.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to DW's Africa Link, and my name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Africa Link is also live on Facebook via DW Africa. And I have Kwasi Amoa Boain, who says, I'm listening to you live from Ghana. And Tramaine Maintang Reali is also streaming live on our Facebook page.
Indeed, thank you for those responses there. Coming up in this half of Africa Link, we meet one man who was very decisive in leading Guinea-Bissau to independence and who rejected the idea of aid with conditions.
The only condition we impose in order to receive help is that you do not impose any conditions on us.
That story coming up as part of our African Roads series. But first, the International Maritime Bureau has once again identified Nigerian waters as being extremely dangerous in its latest report on piracy around the world. More than 20 piracy incidents have been reported since the year started.
The report also indicated that the Gulf of Guinea could become the world's worst piracy-affected area. Our correspondent in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, Mohammed Bello, filed this report.
According to the International Maritime Bureau's latest report on piracy attacks around the world, Nigeria alone recorded 22 incidents in the first 3 months of this year. Of the 11 vessels fired upon worldwide, 8 were off Nigeria, including a tanker with a capacity of 300,000 metric tons, more than 40 nautical miles off Brass in Bayelsa State in the Niger Delta. In 2017, the Bureau reported that over 20 attacks occurred on vessels in the same area. Kabir Adam is a security analyst who heads a Beacon security consultant firm in Nigeria. He said the IMB's monitoring plays a big role in assessing the threat posed by piracy.
If we don't get organizations like that to speak about such things, then unfortunately they go under the radar. They become bigger problems. Yes, I agree with what the IMB has postulated. And the Gulf of Guinea is a huge challenge. If you look at it from a security point of view, it's a challenge. If you look at it from the impact on the use of that corridor for trading purposes, as well as on the insurance component, where ships now, as a matter of necessity, have to insure their crews, have to insure the ship, and most times have to secure additional security cover. All of this translates to additional cost for shipping purposes.
According to the IMB, attacks in the Gulf of Guinea target all kinds of vessels. Crews have been taken hostage and kidnapped from fishing and refrigerated cargo vessels, as well as from tankers carrying refined oil products. The Bureau says it is working with national and regional authorities in the Gulf of Guinea to support ships and coordinate the counter-piracy action. Kabir Adamu said that the Nigerian Navy is responding to the threat.
The Nigerian Navy has changed its strategy till date. I'm aware that it has carried out nothing less than 4 operations targeting specific challenges in that region, some of them internal to Nigeria, and then some of them affecting the entire Gulf of Guinea. The Nigerian Navy also acquired new platforms, including gunboats. It has also re-strategized. I know it has created choke points where any ship leaving Nigeria is checked and its content are ensured that it has followed whatever regulatory procedures are in place.
I contacted the Nigerian Navy public relations official for more details, but the official refused to make any comment, saying he had to seek clearance from the top authorities. This did not arrive in time for this report. However, I was able to speak to an ex-militant who gave this information.
I struck not less than 15 attacks because we have nowhere to start from. Sometimes we hijack the ships to get money and ransom. It depends on the ship. We can't even say 200 million naira or 900 million naira.
Mr. Femi Adesina attributed the rise in attacks in the Niger Delta region to the non-availability of jobs.
When these people see that there is nothing on ground for them to benefit from, to tap from, to do with government or to benefit from, then they go to their own anyhow means. And this is by disturbing the economic activities that will bring money to the nation as like a payback for the pain that the nation has caused.
For shipping companies coming to Nigeria, the continuing piracy threat means they have to invest heavily in security.
Mohammed Bello with that report from the Niger Delta.
And right, Abu, we had that story on our Facebook page. And Diki in Brazil says, Nigeria has never been an easy country, be it in the air, land or sea.
And David from Nigeria says, that's what Buhari government bring to Nigeria. Well, I don't know about that.
And Caleb Chara from Nairobi, Kenya says, even Somalia is now safe. God help people of Nigeria. But piracy is a world problem, same as terrorism. Governments need to wake up and handle the situation before things gets out of hand.
Interesting comment there.
Very interesting.
DW, African Roots.
He was decisive in leading Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde to independence and was one of Africa's foremost thinkers of the 20th century. I'm talking about Amilcar Cabral.
Now, although he considered education an important weapon in the struggle for liberation, Cabral didn't shy away from an armed uprising against the Portuguese colonial power. Eunice Wanjiru presents this report by Carla Fernandez.
Portuguese colonial authorities fire at protesting dock workers in Guinea-Bissau in 1959, killing some 50 people and wounding hundreds of others. This incident, remembered as the massacre of Pitiguti, was a decisive moment for Amilcar Cabral, one of Africa's greatest anti-colonial leaders of the 20th century. Following the killings, Cabral called on the PAIGC party he had helped found to take up arms, says Guinean journalist Tony Checa.
Amilcar Cabral was a man of peace, who was made to make war in order to achieve peace.
Born in Guinea-Bissau in 1924, Cabral moved to Cape Verde as a child where he completed his schooling. He then got a university scholarship to study in Portugal. There he befriended other Africans who would also lead revolutionary movements. Cabral then returned to Guinea-Bissau and worked as an agronomist for the Portuguese colonial authorities. This experience exposed him to the dire poverty of the people, and Cabral started agitating for the independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. Wanting to free both countries was a logical step for Cabral, says journalist Checa.
Sabendo que Guinea-Bissau tinha esse déficit do conhecimento porque...
This idea of the union of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde derives exactly from Cabral's knowledge of both countries. He wanted to combine the knowledge and the learning of the Cape Verdeans with the spirit, the decisiveness, the combativeness of Guinea-Bissau.
A combatividade do homem guineense ao fator conhecimento que já existia em Cabo Verde.
Cabral's writings and theories spread throughout the continent, becoming a source of inspiration for other African independence movements, says Sonia Borges, a Portuguese historian with Cape Verdean ancestry.
Internationalism and international solidarity were always very important for Amilcar Cabral, and the fact that he thought of liberation struggles as a collective process, each one with its own specific national characteristics, made him a reference in several contexts.
Under Cabral's leadership, the PAIGC party began an armed fight against Portugal in 1963. It depended heavily on support from Cuba, China, and the Soviet Union. But Cabral refused to assume ideologies of these countries. He wanted to rebuild an independent Guinea-Bissau according to local needs, not a foreign ideology. Journalist Checa quotes saying attributed to Cabral.
The only condition we impose in order to receive help is that you do not impose any conditions on us.
Cabral was assassinated in 1973, but his struggle for liberation continued, with Guinea-Bissau achieving independence in 1974 and Cape Verde in 1975.
Eunice Wanjiru presented this report by Carla Fernandez, and you tune in on Friday for another episode of African Roots.
Now for some football gossip and a look ahead of some weekend actions. DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold joined me earlier in the studio. I asked him to describe Bayern Munich's new head coach, Niko Kovac.
Well, Niko Kovac came over. He's really made his name at Frankfurt. He's still a fairly young coach. He, as I say, he made his name at Frankfurt because he took them over 2 years ago when they were in the relegation zone. Personally, I think I thought they were probably going to go down. He managed to get them or keep them in the first division through the relegation playoffs by winning that two-legged tie against Nuremberg. Since then, he's sort of steadily improved them. And this year, he's really raised eyebrows by getting them at this point with five games left to fifth in the Bundesliga with every chance of getting into the Champions League next year. So he's been seen as one of Germany's fine young coaches, and it's quite a blow for Eintracht Frankfurt.
Does Frankfurt have a replacement now for him?
No. No, they don't. I was just listening to the press conference where sporting director Freddy Bobic was present, and also Niko Kovac. And Kovac himself said basically it all happened yesterday. It all happened really quickly up until when he got up yesterday morning, apparently Thursday morning. He hadn't expected this at all, so it's just happened within hours.
Before we move into weekend action, let's talk about what happened at the Europa League. RB Leipzig, they lost mercilessly to Marseille. Is it because of the decision of Ralf Hasenhüttl to actually keep Timo Werner, Forsberg and Orban on the bench?
Well, it certainly raised eyebrows. I mean, Timo Werner's got a knock. He's got a thigh injury, so I think that's why he kept him off. I kept wondering if he'd bring him on, especially, you know, when they went down. Forsberg and Orban surprised me, too. The only thing I can think of is that, you know, they're also battling to maybe get in the Champions League. They're battling to stay in Europe for next season. So maybe he was putting his focus on the upcoming Bundesliga match. But certainly he's being, you know, heavily criticized for this today. And they've given up what was, you know, a very good chance of getting into the to the next stage of the Europa League, which would have been a very good result for, you know, a very young team. So people are all asking questions here, definitely.
Thanks for that, Chuck. Let's now look into the weekend action. One of the biggest games, that is the Ruhrgebiet derby between Schalke and Dortmund. How decisive is this game?
Well, there's two factors. First of all, as you say, it's a revered derby. It's the biggest derby in Germany. So no matter where they are on the table, this is one of those games that, you know, and everybody will try to tune into. But the other thing is that they're very close in the table. Of course, you know, Bayern Munich are already the title holders. We don't have to talk about them. But Schalke are in second on 52 points. Borussia Dortmund in third on 51 points. So it's a very key match against two teams that are battling for the Champions League. And there's been a lot of great ones in the past. And, you know, you have to think back to the one in November, the first one that was played in Dortmund, when Dortmund went up 4-0 in the first half hour and you thought Schalke were out of it. And they came back
and tied
it up in injury time with a header from Naldo. So there's a lot of prestige on it, but this time there's the added factor of the fact that they're so close in the standings.
DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold.
Right. Now, Abu, one of our stories that we've covered today is that finally Uganda admitted that it is considering taking up to 500 African migrants being expelled from Israel. And we asked you on Facebook, should your country step in and help the tens of thousands of Africans still in Israel, whether paid or not?
I mean, the controversy behind that is Uganda got money for this, accepting these refugees.
But they say that they didn't get it.
They denied it.
Yeah, they still say that it's humanitarian.
Indeed.
Right. Masaba Putin says Israel must act responsibly because their ancestors were once foreigners in Africa and Israel is a country born out of refugees. So no refugee should deny a fellow refugee the right to live.
And one Momtala Ba said, what? Can't imagine anyone accepting to be unsettled here. If my country made that offer, the response no doubt will be, thanks, but no thanks.
So I imagine that that's a Ugandan saying that, you know, if you're thinking of coming to Uganda, you better think twice before you get in that plane.
Yeah.
Becky Mdlolo says, not a good idea.
And a final one from Agiki Riki says, African Union has to wake up. I think it's time that the Union is given a wake-up call to take care of its affairs. It is sad what Africans are going through in Israel.
It's quite an interesting comment by Agaki, because so far the African Union has been quite reluctant to really come out strongly.
It doesn't in this really, story. I mean, it's a humanitarian crisis affecting Africans living in, some of them have been living in Israel for years and years,
yeah.
And the AU hasn't really stepped up yet.
Exactly. I haven't seen that kind of leadership that says, okay, this is what we want to do for our African migrants. Anyway, thank you so much for all those who wrote in with their comments. And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
It's been a pleasure. And I'm Abubakar Jalo.
Thanks for listening.
Bye now.